sold more than 1 million copies worldwide. His band pledged to carry on, though his wife and 7 children are said to be struggling. Charlene Huntergall, NPR News, Johannesburg.
An axe-wielding Palestinian killed a teenage Israeli boy and wounded a younger boy in a West Bank Jewish settlement today. Police say they are searching for the attacker. Wire services report at least 2 militant groups have claimed responsibility for the attack, which happened 2 days after Israel's new right-wing dominated government took power. The U.S. military says Afghan and U.S.-led coalition troops killed 20 militants nearly 300 miles southwest of Kabul yesterday. More than 24 militants were reportedly killed in clashes on Tuesday. Southern Afghanistan is the heart of the insurgency led by the Taliban and a major opium-producing area. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Seaboat, featuring a southern style of cooking walleye and catfish, chicken, shrimp, sandwiches, and more, available for dine-in and carry-out. The Seaboat, 402 West Kirby, across from Jerry's IGA in Champaign. Catering services available at 355-9933. Programs on WILL are made possible with support from Sinfonia de Camera, presenting Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier at 7:30 p.m. on Friday, April 3rd at the Krannert Center. This concert version of the opera, directed by Nicholas DiVirgilio, features new and returning vocalists from around the world.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is the first hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about life in Viking times and the involvement of the Vikings in North America. And to do that, we'll be looking closely at the life of a Viking woman named Gudrid, who came to be called the Far Traveler, and with good reason. 500 years before Columbus, she landed in the New World. In fact, she went back and forth across the Atlantic, eight times is the number. She had a child when she was here in the New World, and in fact holds a distinction, as far as we know, of being the first European to have a child in the New World. She lived here 3 years. She gave birth to a son and then went home, but her life didn't stop there. She continued to travel and eventually made a pilgrimage to Rome. Fascinating life, and we'll get some of the details this morning as we talk with Nancy Marie Brown. She's author of a book about Gudrid. The title is The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman. The book is out now in paperback and is published by Harcourt. And it's a very interesting story, so you might want to take a look at the book. Just a little bit more about our guest, Nancy Marie Brown. She has over 25 years' experience as a writer and editor. She's graduate of Penn State, and from 1981 until 2003, she covered science and scholarship in all disciplines for Research Penn State magazine. And that, in fact, is how it was that she got more and more involved in this story and was prompted to write the book. And we'll ask her about that. And, of course, questions are welcome here in the first hour of Focus 580. Questions are welcome. Then all you have to do is call us here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. Questions are invited. The only thing we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can keep moving along, but anyone's welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. Brown, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes, thanks for inviting me.
I certainly appreciate it. I'm glad that we could do the show. You know, we were going to talk when the book was brand new and was out in hardcover, and somehow it didn't happen. So I'm really pleased that now, even though it's been some time, we could have the conversation, because I think it's a great story.
Oh, thank you very much.
And maybe just as a way of starting out here, one of the things that I know is that when you were a graduate student at Penn State, you were really interested in the Icelandic sagas and ended up being a science writer, which you really liked doing, but clearly continued to be fascinated by Iceland and by this culture, and that your work as a science writer actually gave you an opportunity to look at this more closely, get up close and personal with it, and that really is why it is that ultimately now we have The Far Traveler.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like I was living a double life for about 25 years because I really had this strong interest in Icelandic literature and in the Icelandic sagas. I can kind of trace that back to my interest in Tolkien, which has been my favorite writer since I was a child. I think my babysitter once told me that she read me The Hobbit when I was 4 years old, so it really is deeply ingrained in me. Mm-hmm. And when I went to college, I started studying Scandinavian literature and mythology, and I realized that's where Tolkien got a lot of his ideas. And that just led me further in and further in. I had to keep reading. I learned Old Norse. I learned Icelandic. I went to Iceland. I absolutely love the country. But at some point, when I was a PhD student, I realized that there are very, very few positions for a professor of Old Icelandic in the United States. And I thought, this is not a career. So at the same time, as I'm looking for a way to fund my graduate degree, I got a job offer to work part-time at a magazine that Penn State published. And I liked it so much, learning to be a science writer and interviewing people about science and really getting this deep education in every single discipline that the university offered, that I stuck with it for 25 years, and I kind of put the idea of being a professor way in the back of my mind. But I kept going to Iceland.
Yeah. Well, then, I guess about 7 years ago, someone at Penn State, an archaeologist, told you about this project that he was involved in. And I'm sure his hope was that you would write about it. And he told you about it. And apparently right away, when you heard the story, you thought about Gudrid.
It's one of those great coincidences. Professors would call the office all the time and say, oh, I have this great research project that you need to write about. And usually I'd go, oh, ho-hum, here's another one, because we had 2,500 professors. Well, this guy called me up, and I had known him before. I'd written about him. His name is Paul Durenberger. And he said, guess what we found in Iceland this summer? Of course, all my antenna are going up. I said, what? That we found a Viking Age longhouse. I said, on what farm? I said, well, it's a little farm called Glumbyre up in the north. I said, that's where Gudrid the Far Traveler comes from. And he was pretty shocked because not everybody knows the sagas that well that you can immediately identify the name of a farm with the name of a character. Mm-hmm. And so I started talking to Paul. I said, how can I volunteer on your project? I don't just want to write a story in the magazine, which I did. I said, I want to go dig in this farm. So he put me in touch with John Steinberg, who was then at UCLA. He's now at University of Boston. No, University of Massachusetts at Boston, excuse me. And he was in charge of the dig, and he said, well, I always need somebody to, carry buckets of mud. I thought, oh, this is going to be fun.
What a glorious job.
Yeah, Iceland in the summer, you can get really bad weather. It can be 40 degrees and raining sideways for days on end. And here I am volunteering to stand out in the middle of a farmer's hayfield and carry buckets of mud. Fortunately, it did turn out that one other thing they needed was somebody to hold the other end of a tape measure. You've got to stretch this tape measure 100 yards, and then the machine, the ground-penetrating radar machine, which he was using to scan the ground underneath the hayfield before we started digging, so he made sure he got the entire house, this machine would run up and down the field kind of like a lawnmower. But you had to do it in a straight line, so we put out the tape measure, and I got to sit there on the edge of the field for 6 hours a day, moving the tape measure a foot at a time, my end of it. So, that was the kind of hard archaeological research that I did.
And did the experience of standing on this place, we have pretty good reason to believe that, in fact, Gudrid stood in this place, this was her place, did having the opportunity to actually be in the place and stand there and look around and look at the landscape that she would have seen if she stood there and looked around, did that help you, do you think, make some connection with her?
Yes, I think it really did. I had a lot of time to, as you say, stand around, and I would look at the mountains that she looked at and think, okay, well, she would have taken her sheep up through that gap, and that's where the water comes down. And if she'd wanted to go to Rome, she would have gone north and then sailed out. And I talked to people about what was the quality of the farmland, that it really is a wonderfully rich, deep soil in that part of Iceland. And I thought about the places that she had been in Greenland and in America, and I said, you know, the farms there were not as good as this one. I can see why she wanted to come back to Iceland. And, you know, just you sort of get a sense with the wind blowing past your head and the sound of the birds and the horses running on the hill. And I, you know, tried to ignore the tractors and the power lines. But you get a sense of what it might have been like, you know, 1,000 years ago. Iceland hasn't changed all that much.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Nancy Marie Brown. She's the author of The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman. The book out now in paperback is published by Harcourt, and it is in part, in large part, the story of the life of this woman, Gudrid. She traveled across the North Atlantic 8 times 1,000 years ago. She was the first woman to have a child in the New World, and in fact traveled through a lot of the known world of the time, including making a pilgrimage to Rome. It's a good story, so you can take a look at it at the library or the bookstore. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The sagas, the Icelandic sagas, will tell you a lot about the life of these people, but they're also a blending of fact and fiction, and only two of them make mention of Gudrid. And I think that for some time, people wondered whether, in fact, Gudrid was ever actually lived, whether she was a real person or not.
Well, they actually wondered whether the whole story was real or not, whether Vikings had ever sailed across the North Atlantic to America and tried to live there. You're right, there's a lot of fiction, fairy tales on those mixed up in the sagas, and you have to be pretty careful as you're reading them not to get carried away with the ghost stories and the fortune telling, and, you know, there's ghosts that walk like zombies and, you know, fun things like that. But when you look at where they went and how they got there and what their ships look like, we put that together with the archaeology, and you can see that they really did go to America exactly the way the saga says. We find, you know, a house in America about where you would expect to find a house if you were following the directions in the sagas. You find a house in Greenland exactly where you would expect to find it if you're, you know, following the directions. There's even a church next to it, which the sagas also tell you about. And then the house in Iceland that they say Gudrid came back to was the one that was discovered in 2002, or at least one that was built at exactly the same time. Archaeologists are careful that you can't actually say Gudrid lived in this house. There's no sign on the door that said Gudrid was here, but it was built at the time that the saga says Gudrid came home and built a house. So that kind of gives you the coincidental excuse to say it is Gudrid's house.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found fascinating is that the more archaeology that is done, the more truth we find in the sagas, the more we do back up, you know, the story that they tell us of these Viking expeditions. And there were probably many, many more that we know of. Many, many more Vikings came to America, but they didn't make it back home to tell the story.
When did the Vikings first make landfall that we know of on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, according to the sagas, the very first person to see the North America coastline was a man named Bjarni, and he was just blown off course as he was trying to get from Norway to Greenland. And he kind of went a little too far, got caught in a storm, and saw this wooded coastline and said, well, that's not Greenland, and turned his ship the other way and sailed to Greenland. When he got there, he talked to Leif Erikson and said, I think I saw a new land. And so, you know, Leif was rather interested in this. And in one of the stories, he set off to find it. In another story, he was, again, on his way home from Norway, and he got blown off course, and he saw a wooded coastline. He said, this must be the place that Bjarni was talking about. And so he did stop. Bjarni never stopped. But Leif stopped. He got out. He looked around. He may have cut down some trees. He may have picked some grapes. One of the sagas says he filled his boat with grapes and sailed to Greenland and said, look what I found. And one of the people who was listening to the story was Gudrid. She was married to Leif's brother. And the next summer, Gudrid and Thorstein, the brother of Leif Erikson, set off to find the New World and to settle there if they could. They got caught in a summer storm and just kind of bopped around the North Atlantic all summer. They ran out of water. They ran out of food. Everyone got sick. Finally, just about the beginning of winter, they recognized some mountains in Greenland and came into a fjord where there were people. And over that winter, everyone who had been on the expedition except Gudrid died. And then a few years later, she sets off again with her new husband, Thorfinn Karlsefni, again intending to settle in the New World. And this time there were three ships, and they did make it to Newfoundland and built houses. We believe they were the ones who built the houses at Lanso Meadow. They lived there over the winter, and the story tells us they traveled around in the summer times. We don't know how far south they went, but it seems from one of the stories that there's a good bet they went at least as far as the Miramichi River in New Brunswick, which is at the southern end of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. Other people believe they went as far south as Georgia, but that's kind of hard to back up with any kind of archaeological data.
Mm-hmm. Here, this is, I think, a remarkable story, and certainly, among other things, says something about her determination and her strength. Here, she sets out with her husband and some other people in a boat and is fortunate to be the only person ultimately to survive that first voyage. And I suppose some people would say, I was very lucky to live and I'm not going to do that again. But then she gets married again.
Well,
me too. You'd think most sensible people would say, okay, we survived that. We're not going to try that again. And here, though, she marries a second time and then with her second husband sets out again, and this voyage is successful, and they live there for several years, and she has her son Snorri there. And it just seems remarkable that having had that experience of surviving the first voyage, that she actually would say, let's try this again. And I think it must say something about the strength of this woman.
That's one of the reasons I was really inspired by Gudrid when I got to know her. When you read the sagas, you realize that the women are, in general, very strong characters, well-organized, competent, and they sort of had to run the farms when their husbands went off on Viking raids and things like that. But they usually didn't go themselves. There are some very famous saga women who asked to be invited along, on a trip to Norway or somewhere else that their husband or boyfriend was going, and they said, no, you stay home with the cows. Well, Gudrid never stayed home with the cows. She said, no, I'm going on this expedition. And when you look at how absolutely horrible it is to be in a boat, an open boat with no shelter at all in the North Atlantic, being driven back and forth past the icebergs in the fog, if it's 40 degrees in Iceland, it's probably 20 degrees off the coast of Greenland. All summer, running out of food and water, just barely making it back to land. Everybody dies. And then she says, let's do that again. We didn't quite get there. And you go, who is this woman? There was no reason for her to do this. There was no, it was a real risk to see, would they make it? Would there be anything there that, they can live on? Is there anything valuable they can take home? And then, of course, after she leaves North America, she goes back to Iceland. She has another son, her husband dies, she raises the two sons herself, she gets to be a grandmother, she's probably about 40, and she says, I need another adventure. It's time to get on a boat again. And she goes to Norway, and then she walks from there to Rome. And you're thinking, wow, this is one tough woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, you touched on something there that was definitely one of the questions that interested me was, were there other women or how many other women would have made a trip like this, that is, the gotten on the boat and sailed across the Atlantic, how many other women might have made that trip or attempted that trip?
I think there probably were more than we know of, because if you remember, the stories were written down about 200 years or more after they happened. And by that time, you had a very different culture. It was Christian, for one thing, completely Christian. Even though Gudrid herself was Christian, it wasn't, not everyone in the Viking world was in the year 1000. By 1300, though, they were. It was a literate culture rather than a storytelling culture. And the people who were educated and who were writing the books were men. So therefore, men got a lot of credit, like Leif Erikson, for discovering America, when there were probably a whole lot more women like Gudrid that you just don't hear of. Their stories were not told, or not written down, at least. So I would think that on Gudrid's trip, there probably were a handful of women, because there were certain things that men didn't do. Men didn't weave. They didn't make cloth, for one thing, and which meant that they didn't make sails. If you're going to sail anywhere in a Viking ship, you've got to have a woman weaving a sail for you. And it took about 4 years for each sail. So you would want to have women along to do some of the chores that, that men aren't happy doing. But we don't know. We do know that a number of Icelandic women at about the same time as Gudrid was living went to Rome because we have their names in the guest books of monasteries along the way. Unfortunately, no one has found Gudrid's name in a guest book. But there are enough Icelandic-sounding names that we do know that other women took that pilgrimage.
You talked about the fact that at one time she was married to the brother of Leif Erikson. So that meant she was Leif Erikson's sister-in-law and Eric the Red's daughter-in-law. So these are powerful names we know in Norse history. Was having that family connection, being associated with these important men, would that have given her an advantage?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's probably the only reason that we know who she is. Eric the Red, although he was outlawed from Iceland, he was a very powerful person in Iceland, and when he went to Greenland, he pretty much set himself up as the only chieftain of this new colony that he established. In Iceland, Gudrid's father was one of his closest friends and backers in the case that was actually a murder case that Eric was outlawed for. And so when Gudrid's father decided to go to Greenland, he was immediately welcomed by his old friend Eric and was given a farm and given all the help that he needed to reestablish himself. So they were pretty much the aristocracy of the time. And I believe that that's why, you know, Gudrid could marry into Leif Erikson's family, was because they were of the same high social status.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Nancy Marie Brown. She has many years' experience as a writer and editor, went to school at Penn State and worked there as a science writer from 81 until 2003. She covered science and scholarship across all disciplines for the Research Penn State magazine, and that was how it is that she got an opportunity to write about and take part in an archaeological dig in Iceland that was believed to be the last home of this woman that we're talking about, Gudrid, who came maybe not in her time, but later to be known as the Far Traveler, and with good reason, because she made several trips across the Atlantic, lived here on this side of the Atlantic, was the first European woman to have a child in the New World, traveled through a lot of the known world at the time, went to Rome. And all of the story is in the book, The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman, by Nancy Marie Brown. It's published now in paperback by Harcourt. So if you'd like to read the story, you're fascinated by the subject of Viking life and would like to read about this very interesting and unusual woman, you can look for the book. And questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Apparently now the thought is that the place where they lived in the New World, what they called Vinland, is what is now Newfoundland. What sort of evidence is there that, in fact, the Vikings were there and did live there?
Well, in the 1960s, Helga Ingstad, who was an adventurer more than a scholar, discovered some Viking houses, long houses, at the very northern tip of Newfoundland. And it took about 40 years for the archaeologists to agree that, yes, this was from the same time as the sagas, and that this would have been not an actual farming settlement, but a base camp for exploration. It does not seem that the people there had more than just one or two cows, and they didn't have an entire herd of sheep, and you can't really live a Viking lifestyle unless you have your animals to provide food and clothing. But these houses up in Newfoundland are bigger than farmhouses in Iceland. They seem to be built the size of one ship's crew. So there were three ship's crews up there. We have found a very few artifacts, or archaeologists have found. I didn't have anything to do with it. They found a cloak pin that a Viking would have worn to close his or her cloak. They found a spindle whorl, which is a part of a spindle that a woman would have used for spinning yarn. And as I mentioned before, men didn't do that kind of work. So we can pretty much assume that there was a woman there who was spinning the yarn. They also found what are called strike-a-lights, what you used to get a spark to start a fire. And these were made of jasper, a stone that can be traced to its origins. And it was very interesting to me to find out that some of these stones came from Iceland, some came from Greenland, and some came from elsewhere in Newfoundland. So we can really see where the people came from who built these houses in northern Newfoundland. Something else they found there in the bog were butternuts, and a piece of butternut wood that had been worked with a metal tool. And if you know anything about the environment of northern Newfoundland, it's not a place where the butternut tree grows. The butternut is also known as the white walnut. In order to find that, you have to go south to the southern edge of the Gulf of St. Lawrence, just on the shore opposite Prince Edward Island. That would be where the northernmost point of the butternuts were. So we believe that in order for these butternuts to get up to Lansometa, they had to have been carried in a ship, in a Viking ship. If you look at the sagas, they always call it Vinland, which is the land of grapes, or the land of wine. And you think, well, you can't grow grapes up in northern Newfoundland, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. But down across from Prince Edward Island at the Miramichi River Valley, you would have found grapes, and you would have found grapes ripe at the same time as the butternuts were. So we think that they sailed at least as far south as that. They explored probably most of the Gulf of St. Lawrence. They may have made it to Quebec, and they also may have gotten out of the Gulf and gone farther south. But they always came back and tried to winter at Lanso Meadows. So that's where we have the most sign of people actually living. One of the problems with finding archaeological proof of the Vikings in this country is that they built out of sod or turf. And if you have a turf house that has collapsed, it looks like, you know, a little hill in the landscape. And if a tree grows up through that hill, you're not going to find it. You're not going to find any archaeological sign of the blocks of turf in their sort of brick-like patterns. So you can only really find the Viking longhouses where there are not a lot of trees growing.
The archaeology will tell you a lot about how these people lived, and the saga, they say something about Gudrid. Apparently, at least they say that she was beautiful.
Yeah.
Much more than that, they really don't say. Maybe they give you some insight into her personality. I don't know. But here, then, this gets to the question of the archaeology. Maybe it will tell you a lot, but it will only take you so far. How, then, do you go from that to trying to think more about, say, an individual, this individual, and think about who she was, how she thought about the world, what her motivation was, trying to get some sort of understanding who she was as a person?
Well, I think I had to really read the sagas carefully and also read not only the sagas that mentioned her, but the sagas that mentioned other women of her time. So the Gudrid that I have come up with is probably a combination of many women. We can get a sense of what their values would have been, what their hardships would have been, what they might have longed for. But we can't really see an individual, especially Gudrid, because in the saga about her, I think she's given maybe one or two lines. She's not very well defined by the saga writer, whereas some other women are. So it's a lot of detective work. I mean, you can put together from the archaeology what you think she might have done every day. I think she might have. She probably had to do an awful lot of weaving. She had to milk cows. So I looked into, well, what was that like? You know, what was the work like of a woman of her time? But it's a lot of speculation.
One thing certainly that comes through here, and one of the things I think you said you had a renewed appreciation for, or a new appreciation for, it was the role of women in Viking society. And I think that what I would have thought, and I expect what a lot of people would have thought, was, well, this is a male-dominated patriarchal society, and that woman would definitely take the back seat. And what is really interesting, you've talked about it a little bit, is that, in fact, women were very strongly positioned in this society. They were important because if the men were off going, if they were off somewhere going on a raid or exploring or whatever they were doing, that the women would have had to run things at home. They would have had to look after the farm. And as you say, they were the ones who did the weaving, and so they made the sailcloth.
Right.
And it was a lot of work, and you had to have a dedicated, committed woman, or maybe a couple of them, to make the sale for you if you were going to go anywhere. So it seems that this is something that really comes through here, just how important they were, and that they had the position that they had, women had in Viking society.
Yeah, that was something that really surprised me. I forget which book I was reading, but when it came to the point of how long it took to make a sale, and that only the women did the work, I'm thinking, well, if you don't have a sail, you're not much of a Viking. You're not going anywhere. So what the men had to first do was make sure their women were happy and productive. You also have to think that the women were responsible for making all the clothing. And one of the most fascinating interviews I did was with two women who were at the University of Copenhagen in their Center for Textile Research. And one of them, for her PhD dissertation, had worked on a Viking sail. How long does this take? Well, she spun the thread, she and one other woman, and it was 1,000,000 feet of thread. And then to weave the sail took them 4 years. So two women working full-time for 4 years could make one sail. And if you're going to take a trip across the North Atlantic, you might want to have a spare sail, because otherwise you're stuck. And then to make your clothes, I think it was 200 sheep you had to shear, wash the wool, spin it into thread, weave the cloth, sew the clothes. You were lucky if you got a new set of clothes once every 3 years. But if the woman is already working that hard just to make clothing for the family, how are you going to convince her to make a sale? So I think the women had an awful lot more power than we would expect reading the stories of, you know, Viking heroes and their big axes. Yeah. You have to have the women back at home working all winter, spinning wool and making things so that you can actually go and sail. And even after the Vikings, after the big raiding era kind of died down, at one point after everyone was Christian, it was really not okay to go to Ireland and knock off a couple of churches and come home. They were still dependent on wool, because that was really the only export product that Iceland had. The only thing that you can grow in Iceland in the Viking Age was hay. So you could only feed animals. You couldn't, you know, make anything else that, you know, you couldn't make honey, you couldn't make mead. They didn't have any resources in, like, silver or much iron. They didn't produce anything but cloth. So the women were really, you know, responsible for the economic prosperity of the whole family. The men would take the cloth, the extra cloth that they had woven, and go to Norway and trade it for wood, which they needed to build their ships and their houses. for grain, for bread, and for ale. So if you didn't make it to Norway that summer, you'd have no Christmas ale, and that was not a happy feast in the Viking time. Mm. You wouldn't have anything to eat except for meat and seaweed. So it was very important that you kept your women happy and productive and weaving as much cloth as possible.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Nancy Marie Brown. The story is the story that she tells in her book, The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman. It's now available in paperback, published by Harcourt. We have several callers, so we want to get them in, and we'll start with somebody on a cell phone. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that the Vikings explored south along the Atlantic coast from Newfoundland, but that they returned to winter at Lancer Meadows. Now, I was at Lancer Meadows in the mid-70s in August. I was very happy to have my winter coat. Why did they go back up there to winter?
Well, if you're used to Iceland and Greenland, Lancer Meadows is not really that cold.
Really?
So it would be the climate that they're used to. But the reason that they went back was that Lancer Meadows was safe. There were no Indians living there.
Ah.
Whereas a couple hundred miles south of
the Dorsets.
The Dorsets, the Beatuck, there were very large populations of Indians living along there. You know, this was before Columbus came and brought diseases. Mm-hmm. There was really a vibrant culture along in Maine and in the northern parts of North America. So they had to walk very carefully. There was only maybe 30 of them in the boat. So you have 30 Vikings with swords against thousands of Indians with bows and arrows, and you can shoot with a bow and arrow from a lot farther away than you can hit somebody with a sword. So they kind of pussyfooted around.
Okay, let's go to Pasodum is the next caller. This is line two. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was curious, was there a historical record or a reason why they stopped coming over to North America? And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay, yeah. Why did they why did they just go home?
Well, the theory now is that they didn't have wood for boats. If you've been to Iceland and Greenland, you know that there aren't any trees there big enough to build a Viking ship. And sometime in the 1200s, their relationship with Norway changed, and so it was not as easy for an Icelander or a Greenlander to go to Norway and have the king give them a ship, which, you know, the sagas I'll tell you about. So-and-so went to Norway and got a ship from the king. The more times you go to America from Iceland or Greenland, the more ships you're going to lose. In Gudrid's story, we hear that there were three ships that set off, but only one ever made it home. So if you're thinking the odds, you're going to send out three, you're going to lose two, you can't make any more. At some point, you can't get there.
Hmm. And I suppose then that also begs the question, why go in the first place? And maybe the answer is, you know, it's the old answer of because it's there.
Well, there's a lot of that, yeah. I think they were hoping to find a place where they could get wood of their own. But in order to, you have to cut down the right kind of trees and you have to season it the right way.
Hmm.
It takes a long time to build a ship. They really have to set up a colony that's going to be there all the time and harvesting the wood. And again, the problem was that it was very highly populated when they were going to America. And they really couldn't just sort of find their niche. They didn't get along with the natives, and they couldn't overpower them because there were just too few of them.
Mm.
So the idea that they could set up a boat-building workshop of their own in America didn't happen. And there wasn't really anything else in Newfoundland especially that they were interested in. There weren't vast grazing lands in Newfoundland like they were in Iceland. So it would be very hard to set up a sheep farm.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. I first read about Gudrid in the book Gudrid Saga by Constance Irwin. It was published in 1974 by St. Martin's Press, just checked on its dates. It happens that Constance Irwin is the stepmother of my brother-in-law, and he told us about this book, and I was just fascinated. It'll be interesting to compare what it's a documentary novel.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to compare what Constance had figured out from research with what you now know, which is more than a quarter of a century later.
Yeah, actually, the state of archaeology has changed so much in the last 20 years. I was just amazed at the new technology that they've been bringing in that allows them to find things and to analyze things. So we really know an awful lot more about Vikings than we did in 1975. And fortunately, some of the new archaeologists are focusing on the role of women and on the role of, you know, the sheep economy, the dairy economy. So we're getting more of the picture. But I have to agree with you that novelists do a great job in putting together these sorts of cultures from, you know, very little material. One of my favorite things to do is to read historical novels, and I try not to read them when I'm working on a nonfiction book because sometimes you get the wrong thing mixed up in your head.
What I remember from it that has retained in my mind all this time was something that she talks about or imagines that Gudrid is nursing an infant on one of these trips, and that she probably had difficulty creating enough milk because she wasn't very well fed herself, or was likely not very well fed herself during parts of this whole deal. And I also can recall her talking about how in Greenland they tried to maintain cattle, and they had to keep them in these sod buildings all winter, and the animals were so weak by the time that the summer came that they had to literally carry them outside. And I don't know what that was based on, but I just...
Well, actually, that's the cow part is based on histories of Iceland between 1300 and 1900, especially if you read some of the tales of travelers in the 18th and 19th century coming from Britain and other places. It really was a hard life, and they did keep the cows inside all winter. It's a sod house, a sod barn, but that's what the people lived in too. So it was actually quite warm and well built. But they did get weak because there wasn't an awful lot of hay. It's very hard to make hay in Iceland, very hard to dry it. And so the animals were pretty much fed starvation rations. And there's many, many stories of when the spring comes late and the farmer lets the cows out for the first time that they can't walk. And so they pick them up and they carry them to the roof of the house, which often has the best grass, and let them lie down on the roof of the house and eat until they get their strength back. There's definitely truth to that fiction. The story about Gudrid nursing the baby, again, that's in one of the sagas that she did have a son. And there's a wonderful scene about when she's rocking the cradle and an Indian woman comes in and tries to talk to her. There's a whole lot of different interpretations of this saga scene, but to me it sounds very much like, you know, a very curious young Indian woman comes in and looks at what's in the cradle and says something in an Indian language that Gudrid doesn't understand. And Gudrid answers her in Old Norse, which the Indian doesn't understand, and they're just about ready to make some sort of a connection when a fight breaks out outside among the Indians and the Viking men who were trading furs for milk or cloth. There's two different versions. And so all the Indians run away. And the next time they come back, they are armed, and a big fight breaks out. But there's this one little glimpse of a possible, you know, communication between these two women from very different countries who are meeting over the cradle of a baby, something they can both understand. And it's just such a beautiful little scene, the way the Indian woman is described. And this was written at least 200 years before Columbus, but if you read this description and then you read descriptions of the Beothuk Indians, it matches just beautifully.
I want to thank the call. I have one more person here I'd like to get in, and we only have about 5 minutes, so I want to go to them in Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I was wondering why the Vikings didn't get credit for discovering the New World versus Christopher Columbus. Because it seems to me, if you look in the history books, they're lacking the account, they're lacking the acknowledgement. Is there any reason for it? I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the reason for it is that these stories were written in Icelandic. And until the late 1900s, they weren't translated into English or into other languages that affected our view of history as much. And so even though many people did know the story of Leif Erikson, it was considered, you know, a fable, a legend. And it's only recently when we actually can put archaeological data to these stories that people are agreeing that, well, they really were here 500 years before Columbus. And a few years ago, there even was a national holiday created, Leif Erikson Day, which is October 9th, 3 days before Columbus Day. And that's not an accident.
Mm. We talked a little bit about how difficult the life would have been for the Vikings here and the various reasons why it turned out that it was just not possible for them to establish a kind of a viable settlement and base here. And eventually, after having lived here for some time, they decided they really needed to go back. You engage in perhaps a bit of imagination here, but you think that maybe it might have been Gudrid who was the one who said, you know, we just can't stay here. We have to go back.
It seems to me that she played a very important role in the expeditions. You know, we talked before about her making the decision to go twice with two different husbands. And if I look at the situation of a woman with a young baby in a place that really hasn't lived up to expectations, you know, she went intending to settle, raise a family, have a farm, and what they found was, you know, a lot of hostile Indians that they couldn't work out anything with. They found no grasslands for their cows and sheep and horses. And I think she started thinking of Iceland and, you know, why don't we just go back? And her husband owned a very fine estate in northern Iceland. He would have inherited it from his father. I'm not sure he knew his father was dead at that point. And I can see that, you know, she would have been talking about, you know, this didn't work out. Let's be practical. What about that farm you have in Iceland? Let's go try that out. She always did seem to me to be the very practical one. She didn't really go exploring because she needed a sense of adventure, though I think she did. She went to find something good.
We have a couple of minutes left, 2-3. Let me ask you a question, and, mm-hmm. and without really being able to give you time to discuss
okay.
as fully maybe as it would deserve, but how did Christianity change Viking culture, and at what point did
you think
really?
That's 3 minutes.
I'm sorry. That's I know that's silly. Maybe you could at least say something about it. And when the point came when it went from being a mix, I think it would have been in her time a mix of pagan and Christian belief to essentially they were basically all Christians.
Well, the year 1000 was a turning point. Both Norway and Iceland became Christian within about 5 years of the year 1000. And in Iceland, it was done by, you know, parliamentary decree. They agreed the whole country would be Icelandic because their major trading partner, Norway, was Christian. And the king of Norway said, we won't trade with you unless you're Christian. So again, it was a very practical reason to make Christianity their official religion. And the concession they made to the pagans was, you can do whatever you like, but we just don't want to hear about it. So you had to be discreet. One of the things that surprised me about the Christianization of the North was that the women were in many cases the leaders of the change. Christianity offered something to women that the pagan religion did not, and that was the fact that every person has a soul that is equal and that can attain heaven. In the Viking religion, the men who died in war went to Valhalla, which was a big feast hall. It was a wonderful place. The women and anyone who died of sickness went to a place called Hel, which was cold, dark, and rainy, just like Iceland. And no one really wanted to go there. Now, if you give me the option of going to heaven, That sounds very nice. Besides which, if you were Christian and had your own soul that could go to heaven, you were not defined as only a wife or a mother. You were an individual who had something of your own. And so this made Christianity very attractive to Viking women. Mm.
And for Gudrid, she at the end of her life, she took orders and became a nun?
Well, we don't really know what it means to be a nun in Iceland in the year about 1025, because there weren't any churches and there weren't very many priests. But what we do know was that a nun was allowed to own her own property, to manage her own estate, and to live alone. And I think that it really, again, was a practical decision on Gudrid's part. She, at that point, owned two farms. She gave one to her son. He ran that. And she lived by herself and didn't have to remarry at the age of 45 or allow her son to make all the decisions for her.
And she lived to be 65. Was that I would think that for the time that would be quite a ripe old age.
Well, that's a guess on my part. We have stories of women living into their 80s, and they are considered extremely old. Gudrid was said to have lived a long time and did see her grandchildren grow up, so I'm guessing that she probably lived into her 60s.
It's a very fine story, and I would sort of encourage people to look at it if you're at all fascinated by the idea of Viking life and the life of this woman who sailed across the Atlantic more than once and came back to tell the story. The book is The Far Traveler, Voyages of a Viking Woman by our guest Nancy Marie Brown. The book is now out in paperback. It is published by Harcourt. She makes her home in Vermont. Ms. Brown, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yes, thanks very much. It was very enjoyable.
WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe, offering breakfast from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. and lunches from 11:30 to 1, Monday through Friday, and catering. Bevere Cafe is student-operated on the second floor of Bevere Hall at the corner of Gregory and Goodwin in Urbana. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation about the practice of silence. Celeste Quinn, she's the host. She'll be talking with writer Anne LeClaire. She turned one Monday into a day of silence some 17 years ago, and today she is silent for two Mondays every month. She says the practice has changed her, strengthening and challenging her. She's written a book in which she sets out some of the ideas and the experiences. The book is Listening Below the Noise, and Anne LeClaire, the author, will be talking with Celeste Quinn. She's the host of the Afternoon Magazine. The interview comes in the 1 o'clock hour of the show today. Anne LeClaire is a former journalist. Her work has appeared in publications including the Boston Globe and the New York Times, and Listening Below the Noise is her latest book. So that's in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up in hour number 2 of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the problem of obesity, and not only just what that means for individuals, but what it means for society and whether or not, as a matter of policy, we should tried to do something about this. Our guest for the program will be Robert Kestner. He's an economist at University of Illinois at Chicago, and he'll be joining us by phone. Right now, though, we'll take a break, as we usually do, so we can bring you an update on the news and the markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Both corn and beans made forceful moves to the upside today, both clearing the March highs, and it's only April 2nd. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars, though we'll begin in Kansas City, where May wheat is at 584.5, up 18.5. At the Board of Trade, May wheat at 542.75, up 17.25. July at 554.5, up 16.25. May corn, 402.75, up 6.75. It's been as high as 407.5 today. July, 412.5, up 6.25. December, 433, up 5.75. It's been as high as 438 today. May crude oil, 52.05, up 3.65. The May RBOB, 145.8, up 8.6. May beans, 980.75, up 28.75. the July at 980, up 28.5. November 918 3/4, up 26.5. It's been as high today.